This is Sam.
And this is Jen.
And this is Pegasus News, where we cover three cool equestrian stories and pull out a lesson in horsenomics from each one of them.
For our first story, we are heading back to China. We spoke to one of the leading experts on the Chinese equestrian industry last week, and so we are going to give you a quick rundown of what's really going on over there in the horse world.
For our second story, we are taking a stroll down history lane to look at how horse racing came to be.
Quick spoiler, but not surprising. It was always about the gambling, and sports histories had to struggle against the regulation against gambling that has come and gone over the years.
For our third and final story, we are looking at the farrier career and job market here in the United States.
How did the farrier come to be? How much can a farrier make in 2021? Where are the jobs and what is the future of a farrier career?
Now, before we jump into those three awesome stories, some quick admin. First, have you subscribed to the Pegasus podcast yet? We would love it if you would hit the subscribe button, and better yet, please leave us a review. We need reviews to help get more equestrian business owners to start listening, thinking, and acting.
And be sure to follow us on Instagram at the Pegasus app and on Facebook at the Pegasus application.
Better yet, join the herd on the Pegasus platform itself. It's completely free to join, and we're about to roll out some awesome new features that will truly help revolutionize the equestrian industry.
Pegasus is currently available as a web-based platform, so head on over to www.thepegasus.app to join the herd. Our team is currently building the app, so we'll keep you posted when that's released into the Google and Apple app stores.
If you want to be on this podcast, either just a shout-out to share the love, or you want to tell the world about the amazing work your business, charity, or school is doing, head over to www.thepegasus.app/podcast.
All right, with all that said and out of the way, let's hit our three stories.
For our first story, we are going back to China to explore the horse market there and the opportunities that exist for enterprising American and European business owners in the equestrian industry.
Yeah, we know we covered this recently in a similar fashion, but we actually had a two-hour call with one of China's leading equestrian professionals this past week. We learned so much that we wanted to circle back while it was fresh in our minds and give our listeners the ground truth on the maturity of the equestrian industry there.
If you like what you hear in this story today and want to learn more straight from the horse's mouth, excuse the pun, then be sure to keep an eye out for our podcast with Zoe from Wonder Horse that will drop very soon, which includes the full two-hour conversation.
All right, so let's jump into it. The first key thing we want to touch on is the history of horses in China from ancient times through to 2021.
We went into our conversation with Zoe thinking that China would have a rich history of horses. We thought surely she was going to give us a detailed account of the important role horses played in Chinese history, as is the case with a lot of things in China, as one of the oldest cultures and nations on the planet.
But she did not. In fact, it turns out it is quite the opposite there in China. Most Chinese people don't have much to do with horses and really never have. They haven't been a big part of Chinese history at all.
Except for up north.
Yes, except for in the north. The country of Mongolia runs almost exactly west to east across China, like a lid to a jar that is China. And Mongolia, for those that don't know, is almost entirely a nomadic nation, meaning the entire population lives as tribes that move around constantly, following the seasons and food supplies.
In the entire nation, there is less than 100 meters of road and even fewer fences. The tribes that live there don't have property with fence lines. It's like one large open plain without borders.
With such wide open plains and a wealth of history on said land, they as a culture have used horses a lot to manage their livestock herds, to hunt, and so on. And in modern times, the history of horse use has transformed into a rich history of horse racing and horse race gambling.
For this reason, the only part of China that has a rich history of using horses are the northern states of China. For example, in central northern China, where they are close to the border of Mongolia, the culture of horse racing has crossed the border into China, and so these states host horse races as well and have a history of breeding horses for this purpose.
Now, if you travel across to the northeastern part of the country, again to the north near Mongolia, there is a rich and growing scene of Western riding competitions and, for lack of a better term, a cowboy culture of wild, risky riding for the fun of it all.
In the rest of the country, however, horse riding hasn't really been that prevalent.
So from what Zoe tells us, in the rest of the country, horse riding as a sport and an activity is a very new thing. And there are two reasons for this. Firstly, China was a poor nation up until the 1990s. If you grew up in China in the 80s or earlier, you did not grow up with any pets. Not only was horse ownership really unheard of, but the citizens didn't even have dogs or cats. The idea of keeping an animal that you had to feed that served no purpose to help pay the bills or, you know, tend to the family was an unnecessary expense and therefore not a cost that Chinese families were willing to pay. So sport horses were just out of the question.
The second reason is that gambling in China is outlawed. We all know equestrian sports like Western and English riding are amazing, but they are, for the grand majority of us, a sunk cost.
And so in a country like China that has only grown wealthy in recent years, there was no financial case to take horse sports seriously. The lowest of the low-hanging fruit when it comes to horse sports is horse racing. It brings in the most money for the athletes, as well as the most money for the local economy, as huge numbers of people gamble, taxes are collected, and so on.
For this reason, horse racing is usually what kickstarts an equestrian economy in most countries. The government supports it because of the huge amount of taxes that can be collected, and operators all make huge amounts of money, and the owners and businesses that enable racing can all get rich as well.
This is a compelling financial and regulatory environment needed for people to start taking the financial risk to start building an equestrian sport infrastructure to make it a reality, including building horse parks, training centers, being able to import horses. You know the drill.
But when the government outlaws gambling, as is still the case in China to this day, horse racing was not there to kickstart the equestrian economy engine. The usual spark plug for the equestrian economy never arrived, and so the adoption of equestrian sport was delayed.
Which brings us to the modern history of equestrian sports in China. So Zoe was tasked by the French horse racing industry to set up operations in China back in 2011. But as she explains in the podcast, it was hamstrung by the gambling restrictions. And so while it is starting to take off there with the workarounds such as raffles for winners, it still really hasn't quite taken off.
So if the racing industry is struggling, which is usually what makes the whole equestrian economy flywheel work, why are equestrian sports like dressage, Western riding, and show jumping taking off in China?
The answer is elitism and Chinese obsession with education. You see, China may not have gotten rich by horse racing, but they did get rich in pretty much everything else. And so since the 80s, the middle class and up in China has grown independently wealthy to the point where they are now able to own pet cats and dogs and now horses.
Zoe explained how in 2015, the number of equestrian clubs in China started to explode, with the number of horse clubs doubling between 2019 and 2020 alone.
And the motivation for this is that wealthy Chinese parents have identified equestrian sports as an elite sport, meaning it's an extracurricular activity that brings prestige and the opportunity to travel and compete internationally in exquisite locations with other wealthy families around the world.
Yes, they see the value in their children rubbing shoulders with other horse riders around the world, and so are investing their money in their kids' future social life and international competition experience.
So now that we know it is growing and why it is growing, what does it actually look like on the ground? What are these horse clubs doing and how serious are they really?
Well, to understand the nature of equestrian sports and clubs in China, you have to understand the most basic principle. They do not have a lot of room.
Yeah, China has a population of 1.4 billion people on a landmass relatively equal in size to the United States. So if you think land costs a lot here and is a premium, in China, land is arguably the most rare commodity.
Yeah, the grand majority of people live in apartments rather than homes, and even fewer people live in homes with a yard, let alone with acreage.
And it is this simple but key fact of China that completely changes the entire equine industry and everything we're used to about how it operates in the Western world.
For example, people cannot keep horses on their own property. If you don't have a backyard or acreage, then you cannot keep your own horse. So you have to keep one at a boarding barn, which isn't that unique to how that we operate here.
But with traffic in a lot of places being so bad because there are 1.4 billion people after all, to get to your boarding barn, we're talking an average 2-hour drive at times, which greatly affects one's willingness to ride, let alone the parents' willingness to take you.
The next major impact this lack of space has on the equestrian economy in China is the way their equestrian clubs and barns are run.
In the Western world, we don't really share our horses. We buy a horse, we build up a training program for our horse, and over the course of many years, we build up a bond with that horse that allows us to complete super complex tasks as we are in sync, but not in China.
No, not in China. There, the model is reversed. Instead of owning a horse and bringing it to training, instead, the clubs own horses and the students turn up and train on the club's horses. They're usually already tacked up and ready to go. Pony Club would be mortified.
Then there is the where. Where do these clubs find land to keep the horses and where do they find the land for the horses to be turned out?
Well, the answer to the first question is quite unimaginable to us Westerners. The answer is they don't have the land to keep the horse. Unlike here in the States, where the majority of boarding barns have large open grasslands to turn horses out in throughout the day, at many Chinese equestrian clubs, the horses live in their stalls, leaving their stalls only to be ridden in their indoor and outdoor arena at different times of the day.
Yeah, so while they make it out of their stalls often to be ridden during a training lesson or exercised, they're not getting out much just to relax and graze and honestly just to be a horse, which is quite sad.
So are you telling me that these horses live in small stalls and move from stall to arena and back to stalls and that's their life?
Not necessarily. While we're sure that this is the case in some of the smaller, really land-starved equestrian clubs, there are some larger clubs that have managed to secure some turnout space. But for everything else in between, well, let's just say the Chinese have gotten super creative.
Yeah, if you can believe it, it is not unusual in China to find an outdoor arena on top of a shopping mall. Let me say that again. It is not unusual to find an outdoor arena on top of a shopping mall, like a place you go to buy electronics, clothes, whatever. Well, on top, where the car park often is here in America, there is a fully built, professionally footed outdoor equestrian arena where the local equestrian club has created the space it needs to ride.
And for those that cannot secure space on top of malls, they are working with local governments to secure local riding trails in and around the cities and parks.
If you can't secure one big open piece of property, then the next best thing is a long riding trail that allows riders to take the horses for a ride around the city in a single direction so they can get some speed up and not worry about horse traffic, walkers, or cyclists.
Which is common in many places. I know you have one of those tracks in Sydney that is often used by local equestrian clubs or boarding barns for their city-dwelling riders.
Right. So we have covered who rides, why they ride, and where they ride. But what about the other side of the sport equation? Coaching. How are the Chinese coaching their students?
Well, if you remember our last podcast on China, we said that there was a huge opportunity for foreign trainers to travel to and live in China and train the local equestrian coaches so that they can develop some expertise. And it turns out we were exactly right.
Yes, in China, they are desperate for foreign expert trainers, horsemen, grooms, etc., to come in and train their local staff.
So we said that there are two schools of thought on the topic among equestrian coaches in China. The first being that they will pay foreign trainers very well to come and live in China and train their students.
The second model is that they pay trainers very well to come and live in China, but instead of training students, they will train the local trainers to make them better so they can build institutional knowledge. Coming back to our earlier point, however, that Chinese parents want their kids to get a good education and participate in a sport that advances that education. Equestrian training is no different.
So Zoe explained that while training there is good in a population with 1.4 billion people, training only counts if you can prove that you got it. And so for the training to be purchased and valuable to the Chinese people, there needs to be a certification at the end of it. And ideally, it will have come from a respected education institution.
So more and more Chinese schools are creating equestrian skill trade and business programs to create that all-important piece of paper that makes the education official and something a Chinese student can put on their resume.
For example, in one province in China, Zoe told us that they have a new equine business school program and that 90% of the graduates had a job secured before they even graduated, which just goes to show how desperate the growing equestrian industry in China is for skilled labor.
So why aren't more foreigners flocking to China to fill the labor gap and cash in on their skills, experience, and expertise?
Well, we asked Zoe this question as well, and there are two answers. Firstly, they have and many have soon left. The Chinese equestrian industry is young, and as a result, it's fair to say they haven't developed a level of horsemanship yet that we are used to in the Western world, where horses have been a big part of our lives for centuries. Consequently, the way a lot of Chinese equestrian clubs treat their horses is what we would call less than desirable, and the foreign staff who come in to train their local staff and students struggle with this.
Hey, are you an equestrian event organizer looking to put on your next clinic or schooling show? Pegasus is about to release its new event management system, which is a modern platform that makes it easy to accept entry registrations, receive digital signatures for your event paperwork, as well as manage the logistics and scheduling of your event. You can even digitally showcase your vendors and sponsors so that brands have much better visibility than the traditional logo on a fence. Pegasus has made it easy to run an event from start to finish with features designed for everyone involved, especially the riders, who can now easily register and receive real-time updates. Gone are the days of running your event through Facebook or tech from the 90s. Check out the launch of the Pegasus Event Management System at www.thepegasus.app. That is www.thepegasus.app.
Apparently the local foreign staff arrive, get settled, are content with the fact that they don't have many friends, and are even content with the fact that they are now in a new place that is less comfortable than home. But what they are not comfortable with is the fact that the horses are not treated as well as they would hope, and in the end, many leave distressed.
Now, Zoe says that this is improving as the sport matures, but for now, it remains a problem in a lot of areas and is one of the leading challenges in keeping foreign staff, even if the money is excellent.
Speaking of money, this leads us to the second answer. The other thing that is happening is a different model. Rather than foreign staff flying in and living in China to train full-time, companies like Breitling are setting up training academies run and managed by famous European riders to train the locals and qualify them as equestrian trainers and the like.
And they're doing very well. The foreign trainers are only in town for short periods of time when the courses are run. So there is an over-demand of willing, paying students and an undersupply of courses and spots on courses available. And so they are selling out and charging really high prices. So the businesses that are running this training school model with part-time foreign staff are doing very well.
Yeah, if you are an experienced trader with some good competition experience under your belt, maybe look into this. It could be a new and exciting way to make some extra cash if you become an instructor at one of these academies.
All right, I think that is enough for today's story on China. What's our takeaway here, Sam?
We spoke with Zoe from Wonder Horse this last week, and she gave us the ground truth on the history and present state of the Chinese equestrian industry. In a country of 1.4 billion people, the need to build your resume to stand out and the lack of space available are almost single-handedly driving the growth of the equestrian industry. More and more Chinese parents are entering their kids into traditional English riding equestrian sports, hoping that it will give them the opportunity to travel and compete internationally and meet some wealthy people overseas. And the lack of space has created a model whereby clubs own their horses instead of the students, and the students rent them out to learn how to ride. The one thing the Chinese have not cracked yet is how to train local staff at scale yet, and so are doing their best to attract foreign equestrian professionals either as live-in staff or as fly-in, fly-out coaches. In the next 5 years, the real opportunity for equestrian businesses in China will be solving the labor shortage and education problems, after which everything else will come. If you want to learn all this in more detail, as well as much, much more, keep an eye out for our two-hour conversation with Zoe about the Chinese equestrian industry that will drop very soon on this podcast channel.
For our second story, we thought we would take a stroll down memory lane and look at the history of horse racing and how it came to be what it is today.
So we mentioned in our first story how pivotal horse racing and gambling on said horse racing is to kickstarting an equestrian economy. And we care about horse racing as non-racing riders because racing in many ways enables the rest of us to do what we love to do. So we thought it important to understand how modern horse racing as a sport came to be and how it came to America, as we have so much to thank it for.
So let's get into it. It is believed that modern horse racing originated in England during the 17th and 18th centuries.
There were many taverns and inns scattered throughout London at this time, and gambling occurred in them often.
At first, horses were raced without saddles or riders as a test of speed and strength, but this changed with time and fashion. They became part of mock battles, whereby mounted soldiers rode at each other to simulate war.
Eventually, a club called the Four Horse Club was created, and they hosted the first ever organized horse race at Newmarket, London on October 17th, 1665. John Evelyn, who was a founding member of Royal Society, recorded this in his diary that five horses ran about 2.5 miles, which would make them the earliest record from England. And he recorded that five horses ran about 2.5 miles, which makes it the earliest record from England.
24 years after it was first organized, horse racing was halted in Newmarket because a law was passed banning gambling except at authorized race courses. In 1751, Parliament declared it illegal to conduct a race for money anywhere in England and banned the advertising of such races.
But fortunately, King George II, who was a pretty avid gambler himself, came to the rescue. In conjunction with the Four Horse Club, he created the Jockey Club and hosted horse races on his own private course at Newmarket.
Gambling and horse racing became so rampant with huge stakes and profit margins. This led to owners inevitably wanting to make sure their horses always got first place to maximize their profits. So they began breeding and training faster horses in order to win more consistently, even hiring professional jockeys jockeys for the first time to maximize their chances of winning.
Eventually, racing became so popular that a subculture around it was born, as anyone with some sort of horse in the race world would be present to watch and cheer. As more and more organized groups began to attend the races, the culture of going to the races, and I say that in quotation marks, was born. But not yet with gambling, or at least official gambling, as it was still outlawed.
Horse racing continued like this until 1814, when the English government passed an Act of Parliament banning all forms of gambling in order to curb public spending on betting. But it didn't stop horse racing from continuing even after that ban. They simply ran races in secret.
Then 10 years later, in 1823, Parliament overturned its ban on gambling across England and Wales, and horse racing was finally able to become the sport they all wanted it to become.
That said, it was another 20 years until the first formalized rules were actually established. In 1853, they passed the first set of official rules for flat racing, and it wasn't until 1875 that they started to incorporate photos of the finish line to be able to prove who actually won each race.
So up until then, the times were simply given by judges, who were often biased towards horses that they liked.
The first photo finish camera was created after some research done by Charles Eastlake, a photographer who was commissioned by the Jockey Club to take pictures of races. Some critics noticed that the first photo finish camera was flawed, as it couldn't capture all horses in motion at any one time, so there were still some times where people would estimate a winner rather than prove it.
This became a problem as gambling and bookies started to really take advantage of this wiggle room. As sure as the sun will rise tomorrow, if there is money to be made and opportunity to grift people, then someone will take advantage of it. And so in these early days, there was a lot of buying off judges and fixing races. Surprise, surprise.
So in 1859, the first rule was created to help curb cheating. The rule determined that jockeys could no longer bet or accept bets against any horse in which they themselves rode, because this obviously could have been used to extort money from people if anyone found out about it and wanted to blackmail a jockey into rigging a race.
Not long after, in 1868, the Racing Managers Association was created to govern and regulate horse racing.
Within another 10 years, now we're in 1878, another rule was created that centered around equine doping. It was made illegal for any jockey riding a racehorse to administer any amount of drug or chemical substance into their system 30 minutes before a race began.
Just 6 years later, in 1884, drug testing became officialized when two chloral hydrate pills were found inside the mouth of a jockey's horse after a race in Epsom Downs.
It was at that moment that the Racing Managers Association decided it was time for a formal and complete set of rules to be made.
This became known as the Rules of Racing, which is still used today, created to help prevent bias in betting and extorting people through blackmail, as well as curb any drug use during races. The first official rule book was published in 1885 with just 18 rules. Today, there are almost 2,500.
A cool milestone in racing is that the first official female jockey was recorded in 1891. That was Charlotte Brew. She managed to win a race on her second outing the following day after having been refused entry into a race course because she was a woman.
Around this time, another milestone was hit when horse racing became more accessible to everyone by way of gambling. In 1894, bookies were given legal permission to open their own headquarters on the racecourse, which allowed them to set up shop earlier so they could begin taking bets before the start of each race.
This was a big deal, as horse racing had always been considered a high-class hobby at the time. But with this new avenue to make money, the sport became rampant with corruption and cheating, which in turn caused large protests from people in England.
The solution to this problem came from a guy named John Rann, who invented the first mechanical totosillator, which was a form of gambling that involved using modern technology to calculate all the odds and payouts for people who were making bets.
It was such an elegant solution to betting that this type of gambling became immensely popular because it allowed for more people to make more money from their investments in it. Before, most bets had been made using money or certain goods like horses, cattle, etc., but now they could use their own money and get winnings by the end of the day when the race was over.
So due to more accepting laws and better gambling technology, horse racing spread all across England and has grown ever since.
So what about here in America? When did horse racing come to the States?
Well, almost immediately, actually, which goes to show the appeal of the sport. The Newmarket England race was officially established in October 1665, and a few weeks later, a group of men started horse racing on an island up the Hudson River, and they called their little club the Newmarket Club, a great little tip of the hat to their peers across the pond.
The races took place on Manhattan Island, which is now part of New York City, and are considered to be the first official races ever to be held in America. Mm-hmm. But considering we didn't become an actual nation until 1776, then I'm not sure we can call it the first horse race in America. But let's not get bogged down by that now.
Unlike England, horse racing never really took off in America because laws kept coming and going, sometimes for decades at a time, that made it illegal to bet on horses.
For example, between 1750 and 1774, it was legal to bet on horse races in the New York colony, and then it was made legal. And then again, from 1813 to 1837, it was outlawed again. This coming and going of laws made it very hard for anyone to invest money in building the horse racing infrastructure, because if they did and it was outlawed again, then the track would fail and they'd go bankrupt.
It started coming back around when they made the law a bit more lenient on betting so that people could place bets with licensed bookmakers like they did in England. But still, only a handful of racetracks were being built and a lot of them didn't last very long. It wasn't until 1934 that we got our first thoroughbred track, which opened in Northfield Park near Cleveland, Ohio. There were other places that had horse racing before that, like Pimlico Racecourse in Maryland, which was opened in 1870, and a few other little spots here and there.
But really, the first one was in Ohio. It was called Thistledown, which is still open today.
In 1959, we got our first ever Kentucky Derby, and after that came the Preakness Stakes, Saratoga, Belmont, etc.
Since then, around $7.7 billion has been wagered in horse racing in America, and the rest is history.
While horse racing is still very popular today, it has decreased since the late 1800s and early 1900s, which was its absolute glory days. There are many reasons for this decline, but the two key reasons are firstly, racing cars were created in the 1920s, which stole a large portion of the spectator base. And the same problem exists today with other forms of entertainment like televised sports and Netflix.
Secondly, public pressure surrounded animal cruelty. Of all the equestrian sports, horse racing receives the greatest pushback from animal rights groups. And in the last 10 years, it's escalated to the point that historically large and extremely popular events like the Melbourne Cup in Australia are being protested with large public requests to have the event canceled due to the animal abuse concerns.
Right, that brings us to the end of this brief history on modern horse racing. But before we wind it up, a cool little tidbit you can tell your non-horse friends. The history behind the name, the Gold Cup.
The first Gold Cup was held at the original racetrack in Newmarket in England, way back when it first opened in the 1660s.
The story goes that King Charles II, who lived from 1630 to 1685, commissioned a set of three magnificent goblets that were made out of solid gold. But right after his death, the extreme value of the gold made it impossible for anyone to buy the goblets, and they lay forgotten in the Queen's personal collection for over 100 years.
Then, when things are looking bleak for King George II, he was able to buy them from the Queen's collection with a hefty sum of money. This was back in 1756, thinking it would be a good way to make even more money.
With goblets in hand, he contacted his friends at Newmarket about making a set of 10 new gold trophies to replace the silver ones that were then being given to the winners. He ended up keeping one for himself, and the rest were given to the winners of the Newmarket races, and they are still used today.
So on that final note, what's our takeaway here, Sam?
Modern horse racing started in England where guys would get drunk in taverns, walk out into the streets and gamble on drunk men racing each other on their horses. In 1665, they made it official in Newmarket when they started to host official horse races. As the sport grew in popularity, so too did the gambling, and with the gambling came cheating. This resulted in the need for rules to be established, which helped create a fair racing field and thus a fair gambling opportunity. One-time laws came and went to try and curb the gambling and cheating, but as with most things, technology improved and the gambling became more legitimate. This opened it up to the masses, which cemented the sport as a nationwide activity and popular international sport. Horse racing was in its prime in the early 1900s, but has since waned in popularity as different forms of entertainment have stolen its spectator base and animal rights groups have grown stronger in their opposition of the sport.
For our third and final story, we are looking at the state of the farrier job market and the career pathway here in America.
Yes, we all know and use farriers that we have probably been using for years and have come to know them as friends. But we never really stop to think about how they make their living, how they get into the trade, and whether or not they earn enough money to make life easy or hard.
So today we decided to look at the farrier job market in detail and really understand the world our beloved farriers live and the possible future that they have ahead of them.
Before we jump into the present and future, let's take a little look at the history of farriers and horseshoes in general, simply because it's interesting.
The history of the horse and farriers dates back thousands of years. The earliest evidence of horse hoof care dates back to 2900 BC with the ancient Egyptians, where drawings shown evidence of them trimming horses' hooves.
Not too long after, in 2500 BC, which is not long after by ancient history standards, the Japanese started to use horseshoes. And then in 600 BC, during the Zhou dynasty, the Chinese began using the first recorded metal horseshoes when they commenced mass production of casting metals, which allowed them to create horseshoes and even invent the first recorded metal bridles and bits at scale. Despite the technology, however, they did not nail the horseshoes to the horse's feet, but instead created a shoe that clung onto it and sat a little loose.
After the Chinese came the Romans, who created the first shoes made of iron that were nailed to their horses' hooves around 300 BC. It was not widespread, however, as it required access to a skilled blacksmith who at this point in time was rare and even more expensive than most people could afford.
For that reason, it took almost another 1,000 years until the Middle Ages, around the 12th and 13th century, that horses started to be shod on a regular basis. At this point in history, people had more money than ever before and were starting to live longer lives and as such needed horses for work and war for longer periods.
As horses were expensive and in the context of work, it was equal to your ability to farm your land effectively or in war, equal to your ability to defeat your enemy, keeping a horse alive and well became a major priority and something that the average person could afford. And so for the first time in history, shodding horses became quite common.
In 1835, the first US patent for a horseshoe manufacturing machine capable of making up to 60 horseshoes per hour was issued to Henry Burden, and the rest is pretty much history, as horseshoes went mainstream and dramatically decreased in price and value.
So that catches us up to today. And while yes, the horseshoe has decreased in value, the skill required to effectively fasten a shoe to a horse has not, because it is a rare skill that cannot be done by a machine and a skill that every horse owner needs to pay for, hence the career as a farrier.
So what does the farrier job market in America look like? Do they have a healthy future? Because it's one of those careers that feels like a career from yesteryear that may be in danger of dying out as the new generation coming through displays less and less interest in the profession.
Well, according to data modeled to look at 2015 to 2025, it's the opposite. The farrier job market is doing relatively well compared to the rest of the job world.
To put the following job market data in perspective, when it comes to employment data, full employment across the economy by traditional economic teachings is considered to be about 5%, meaning only 5% of the population is unemployed.
Most advanced nations like America, Australia, and England will hover around a total economy unemployment rate of 5-7% when things are really good.
When they get really bad, like during the 2008 financial crisis, the unemployment rate will rise. In 2009, for example, at its peak unemployment, America hit an unemployment rate of 9.3%.
Yeah, and at the peak of COVID in April of last year, when everything non-essential was completely shut down, the unemployment rate in America hit 14.8%.
So now that we understand that full employment is considered 5% and high unemployment is considered 9% plus, let's look at farrier employment data in America and see how it fares compared to the economy at large.
Well, looking at the top 10 states in America for farriers, the average unemployment rate for farriers is 3.6%, which is better than the 3.8% unemployment rate that Americans were very proud of prior to COVID.
And that data was calculated prior to COVID, before the national interest in horses rose and thus the demand for farriers rose. So it is most likely better than that now.
So essentially that tells us that if you invest your time and money in training to be a farrier, you are essentially guaranteed employment upon graduation. So if you think of education and certification as an investment, then it's a great one because you will most definitely get your money back when you get a job soon after graduation and earn back the money required to pay for your training.
And for those listeners that are interested in considering a career as a farrier, the top 10 states to be a farrier are as follows. And not surprisingly, they pretty much mirror where the largest horse populations in America are.
All right. So number one, of course, is Texas. Texas employs about 2,560 farriers.
Texas is followed closely by New York that employs about 2,510 farriers.
Next is Georgia that employs 1,460 farriers, followed closely by Florida that employs 1,230 farriers.
After that, you have New Jersey, Virginia, Arizona, Michigan, Nevada, Colorado, Pennsylvania, Iowa, and Missouri, all of which employ between 500 and 1,000 farriers each.
So that covers the employment rate, but what about the future growth of the industry?
Yeah, we mentioned earlier how when we think of being a farrier, we think of a career that may have been very popular with our grandparents' generation, a little less popular with our parents, and outright unfathomable as a career to many in our generation.
But maybe that is very much a city kid lens we are looking at this through, because there obviously are farriers out there, and so somewhere there are people training to become farriers and fill those ranks. So for those that fall into the camp, what does the future of their industry look like?
And the resounding answer is their future is very bright.
If you want to assess the future potential of a job market, you want to look at the growth rate of the industry. Why is it important to know your dream job's projected growth? Because it gives you valuable insight into how easy it will be for you to get employed in that particular occupation.
Let's take your average college education requirement in America to put this in perspective. Say that you already know what career you want to pursue. You'll probably need to complete at least 4 years of undergrad study, if not more, to qualify for the job. You also know you might graduate with student loan debt. But how do you determine if the time, money, and effort you invest into it is worth it? Will you get the job easily after you graduate?
One way to find out is by checking the projected growth rate for that career. A high projected growth rate means jobs in this occupation are on the rise. With more jobs available, you will find it easier to get employed in this role.
The projected growth rate is usually indicated in percentages.
A projected growth rate of 14% or more indicates that that job is growing faster than the average. This is great news for you.
Projected growth rates between 9 and 13% also indicate an increase in job opportunities, but at a slightly slower rate.
Projected growth rates between 2% and 8% indicate an even slower growth rate. It means job opportunities are on the rise, although the rate of increase is slow.
Projected growth rates that are any lower than 2% or show a decline are bad news. You may find it difficult to get employed in any job that has a low or negative projected growth rate.
So, circling back to the fair job market in the States, let's take a look at their growth rates. And remember, what we're looking for is a job growth rate higher than 9% if we're to be optimistic, and higher than 14% if we are going to be extremely optimistic.
Starting with numero uno, Texas. For Farias over the next 5 years, it has a projected growth rate of 9%. So not bad. Very good, but not excellent.
Next is Florida. Florida has a projected fair job market growth rate of 11%. So now we're getting excited. That's only 3% short of very exciting growth.
Then there are New Jersey and Virginia, which have growth rates of 15 and 16% respectively, which puts them in the hyper-growth job market territory. And honestly, the news only gets better from there.
We have 18% in Arizona,
17% in Nevada,
20% in Colorado,
13% in Ohio,
and 17% in Pennsylvania. So all hyper-growth areas.
Now, of course, there are some down areas. In Iowa, for example, the Farrier job market growth rate is only 7%. In Missouri and Michigan, the growth rate is as low as 3%. So if you're a new Farrier, just avoid those places if you can help it.
Okay, there is one last thing to look at when it comes to employment, and that is all the important salary. It's all well and good that you get a job, but does it pay enough? I mean, we can all go work at an Amazon fulfillment center, but do we really want to?
Yeah, exactly. So let's break down the numbers here.
Looking at current job market data across America, the average fair earns a salary of around $52,000 a year. 21% of fair jobs in the United States pay between $55,000 to $100,000, and only 2% of fair jobs in the United States are paying over $100,000.
But that's for employed farriers. That does not take into account farrier business owners.
Yeah, to be a farrier is to be a tradesman. Rather than going to college and then getting a salary job and working your way up a corporate chain for 30 years, a farrier career trajectory follows the tradesman pattern. You graduate, get a low-paying salary, working for an experienced farrier while you learn the trade and master your skills. Then you break out on your own and start your own business. You recruit your own clients, and then as you grow, you hire your own staff that you will then train until they leave you and start their own business, and the cycle continues.
And it's when you break out on your own and start your own business that you start to make bank. Same as any other trade.
So while this data is 10 years old now, we found some data from 2012 that showed that the average farrier, who is a business owner as opposed to a salaried employee, makes around $92,000 a year after costs. And it can be much higher if you work in the racing industry as opposed to, say, the sport horse industry.
So in summary, when you start out, you make a better salary than most college graduates. And when you start your own business, you make a six-figure salary if you run it well.
All right, that's a lot of data thrown at you. So we'll save you and wind things up. What's our takeaway here, Sam?
Farriers have a rich history in this world due to the important role horses have played in farming and war. In modern times, to be a farrier is to many quite an abstract concept, but the data reveals that it is still quite a profitable and opportunistic career choice. The current employment rate for farriers is excellent, and the growth of the farrier job market in America is in hypergrowth in most horse-dense places. And on top of all of that job security, you can expect to earn anywhere from $50,000 to $100,000 a year plus. And so, if you are wondering whether investing in becoming a farrier is worth it, the answer is a resounding yes. You will get a job when you finish your training. You will have the opportunity to move around until you find a place you actually want to live. And you will earn enough to live a very comfortable life.
All right, that's it from Pegasus HQ this week. We hope you enjoyed those three stories.
A quick reminder that we grab these stories from the news page on the Pegasus platform each week. So if you want to learn more about these stories or just enjoy a variety of global equestrian news in a single, easily scrollable place, head over to www.thepegasus.app/news.
If you're keen to learn more about Pegasus, including the features our team is building for the equestrian community, follow us on Instagram at the Pegasus app and on Facebook at the Pegasus application.
Lastly, if you want to be featured on this podcast, either just a shout out to share the love, or you want to tell the world about the amazing work your business, charity, or school is doing, head over to www.thepegasus.app/podcast.
And before we go, we want to give a shout out to some of our newest Pegasus members.
Welcome to Helena Harris, founder of the Horse Radio Network and a fox hunter from Rhode Island.
And welcome to Margot Cronin, a hunter jumper from Old Town Alexandria, Virginia.
And welcome to Anna Ross, a dressage rider hailing from the United Kingdom.
And a warm welcome to Kat Brooks, an equestrian enthusiast from Area 1 back here in the United States.
And lastly, congratulations to Ashley Bond, who absolutely crushed it at the Tokyo Olympics this year.